Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, Mets fans. This is Rich Farrago, known as CT Mets Fan on Twitter, and you are listening to another edition of the Metsian Podcast. And should I say good evening, or should I say good big series eve? Because that's exactly where we are. It's been 3 weeks to the day since there was a Metsian Podcast, and a lot has happened in Metsville since then. And to peel back this onion and talk about everything that's coming and everything that's happened since we were last on the air, I'd like to welcome one of my partners in podcasting, the man that we often refer to as the grand poopah of our podcasting operation. That is Mr. Sam Maxwell. So, Sam, my same two questions I ask you every time. How are you and where are you? Because you get around. So let us know how you're doing and where we might find you tonight.
I'm doing well. I'm still kind of on the high of last night. That was just exhilarating. Coupled with a nice baseball moment with Aaron Judge tying Roger Maris. I'm great, and I'm in Flatbush right now, you know, in tucked away in a quarter of Brooklyn that has some National League lore to it. And I'm looking forward. I mean, when was the last time the Mets were in this position? I can't even remember, and so we're in unprecedented times, and I'm really excited about it.
And I think that's well said. And Mike's not able to join us tonight, so we do have a special guest. And this is a guy that we've had on before, and we have Mr. Metrodamus himself, known as Metrodamus on Twitter. John is a friend of this podcast. He's been on many times. I find his takes to run from very funny to very insightful. He's a great guest to have on, and we're thrilled to have Mr. Metrodamus himself on tonight. So, John, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, man. Thank you for the kind words. I agree with Sam. These are kind of unprecedented times. I wrote on my blog yesterday that we might be headed into the most important road series in the regular season that we've had maybe since 1985 when we marched into St. Louis and took two out of three when we needed a sweep. So this is going to be – this is a lot of fun. This is the season that Mets fans have hoped for, and it's upon us, and it's right there for us. So it's going to be a great 3 days with some ups and some downs, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Same, you know, and I'm going to go a little bit off script here because I wasn't really planning to start right in this one spot. But John, you just brought it up, and I want to go with it at this point. So I'll start with you, then I'll go to Sam. You said the magic words just now that, you know, it's a great spot to be in, you know, three exciting games, and it's all on the line. Maybe those weren't your exact words. That was the spirit of what you were saying. So let's start with this. There's a very divided school of thought out there in Metsville about exactly what's happening here. So let me explain. Some people take the approach of, you know what, they're in the playoffs anyway. Sure, you want to win the division. Sure, you want the bye. But let's not lose sight of the big prize. They're in the playoffs anyway. Let's not get too hyped up about the division. If you have to be a wild card, you're a wild card. Last year the Braves were. They won the division last year. Take that back. But other teams that have won the wild card have marched onto the World Series. So I'm not saying that the fans are saying it's not a big deal, but it's not a very big deal. Then there's the other side of the coin that for a lot of reasons, winning this division is, I'll say, tantamount to people. And I'm in that camp. And it could be because you don't want to lose the division after leading it for all of but one day since early April. So that's part of it. But the more realistic part is you don't want to play in that first round. You don't want to have another round where you could potentially get knocked out. You want to have a chance to rest your guys, set your rotation, all those things. But there are two very distinct camps out there. So, John, I'm going to start with you. Which camp are you in?
I'm in the latter. And everything you said about being in the former camp is absolutely true. You can win from the wild card spot. And if you're lucky, it's only – if the Mets do have to play it from the wild card spot, you're talking – you're throwing out there DeGrom and Scherzer, correct? Now, the first – and if in the perfect scenario they win both games, and then when the division series starts on the 11th, which is 4 days after the first day of the wild card series, you can come back with Chris Bassett for game one and then go DeGrom, Scherzer on normal rest in games two and three. So perhaps it's not the biggest deal in the world. But I am of the mind that I'm in the latter. I want the division really for two reasons. Number one, because if you face Atlanta again and you're the wild card, then they get game seven at home. And Atlanta's a very good game, a very good team at home. So I want to make sure that if I face them in a game seven, it's at home. And I realize there's nothing you can do about the Dodgers. They're way ahead of everybody. And if it's them, so be it. But the second reason, and I think is more important, the Mets are the oldest team in the league. I think the oldest team in the league used 6 days off. I think that for the past month, what I wanted Buck Showalter and Billy Epler to a point to do was make every decision based on getting this team to October 11th healthy and rested. If this was a younger team, I'd say, you know what, not a big deal. Oldest team in the league, give them 6 days to rest their bones. I think that makes the difference for me. So I want the division for those two reasons.
Well said. So, Sam, where are you? Where do you come down in this particular, I'll call it a debate, because it is a pretty wild one on Twitter.
I can't even believe that there is a debate. How nobody sees how winning the division, how this is one of the most important tasks that the Mets have ever faced in their history. And from a symbolic perspective, if you look at it, you know, a lot of people on here know that I'm a screenwriter who are listening out there. And so I'm looking at it in many ways from the thematical sense. And this is the 61st season. It has been 60 years since the Mets started, and we know what their general narrative has been, what the general consensus of the overall viewership and culture that surrounds the Mets. And this is, especially after last year in Cohen's first year, that there were a lot of changes, but it didn't come completely to fruition. A lot of the leftover from the Wilpon ended up having it be a profound historical not making the playoffs, really, even though they didn't have the same, like, epic 17-game collapse like in other years. It's right now they need to stave off the Braves. And think about the position they're in. Obviously, best-case scenario, the Mets have the ability to clinch on the Braves' field if they sweep the series. And that's crazy to even consider, and I don't expect it to happen because I think hopefully best-case scenario, that's the best-case scenario, but, you know, we could really just hope for two out of three here, where that means right now you want to win that first game so you are not tied going into the second game. Digress and get ahead of myself. This is just a major opportunity to not only not leave a sour taste going into the playoffs if they were to be, like John said, you know, having to deal with going to a game seven if they ever face the Braves again, but even having to deal with another team upsetting them possibly in the wild card round. This is not something you want regardless of well, they're in the playoffs regardless. Think about what it means. Think about what yesterday could mean. And what it's set up for going into this series. This could be one of the – yesterday could have been one of the biggest intersections of this franchise's history, quite possibly, and where we look back on it being a crucial moment in this season, hopefully, you know, marching onward down the Canyon of Heroes. So it's just – as you can hear, you know, I'm not really on the caffeine that John's on, as he said on Twitter pre-show, but I'm still jonesed up. And yes, I did have a few coffees earlier in the day.
Well, it's National Coffee Day, so that kind of makes sense. But all right, let's talk about that. I want to probe on that one a little bit more, because I really believe, and John, I'm going to go to you on this one first. I really believe this is one of those scenarios where you say everything can possibly be true. Like, it doesn't mean that one thing's right and one thing's wrong. So here's what I mean by that. Yes, think about where the Mets are versus where they were last year, where they had the collapse and it was just abysmal at the end of the season and, you know, the thumbs down and it was a bit of LOL Mets coming back. Think where the Mets had been before that, you know, with Mickey Callaway and all the stuff that happened there. And before that, yes, there was a World Series appearance in there, but, you know, the Terry Collins years. So some people say, well, the franchise is in such better shape. They made the playoffs. It's only been 2 years under Cohen. It's only going to get better. What are we worried about? It's still a playoff team. True, 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 true. Check, check, check. But also, John, you made the point, and I want to focus on that here. This is an older team. This team is built to win now, okay? Let's harken back to the 86 Mets. John, you and I were around then. After the 86 Mets won, when they were in the Canyon of Heroes, Mookie said, 1986, year of the Mets, 1987, year of the Mets, 1988, year of the Mets. The point is that we always think as sports fans, it's the beginning of a dynasty. You know, this is great. This is going to go on forever. Do you know how hard it is to have a good year? We can't just say, yeah, you know, great progress, Steve Cohen era, we're on a new course, as if next year is guaranteed and the year after that is guaranteed. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if DeGrom signs somewhere else. We don't know if Scherzer gets hurt. You've got to go for it while it's here. And a big part of going for it while it's here is winning that division and getting home field and missing that first round. John, your thoughts on all of that?
Oh, agree with all of that, and I'll take it a step further. How many times, and if I could switch to hockey for a second, you know, the Rangers just had a great season. They made the semifinals. They're a young team, unlike the Mets, but the one thing they said about the Rangers after they lost to Tampa in the semifinals was that this team has a bright future ahead of them. They will definitely – how many teams – have you watched where they would say that they would say this team is definitely going to be back. The Bengals are definitely going to be back in the Super Bowl. The Memphis Grizzlies are definitely going to go further next year. They're a young and exciting team. Dan Marino is definitely coming back to multiple Super Bowls. So you're right. You don't know where this, how this is going to end, because if the Mets do go to the World Series or go to the National League Championship Series and say, you know, they lose in six to the Dodgers, which there would be no shame in that. But it wouldn't, you're right, it wouldn't be a guarantee to say, hey, they're definitely going to be back. This is the beginning of something special, like you said. It is an older team. And I do think that it's that if you're going to go for it, you go for it now. And I think that's why a lot of fans got frustrated with the way Buck Showalter managed the bullpen down the stretch, seeing what guys had in September, pitching guys that you really shouldn't see in situations down the stretch. And I love the way Buck managed the bullpen all year round, but I do kind of understand what people say, all right, well, this is crunch time here. You've got to go for the division. But the way this team has performed, I trust Buck. I trust in what he's doing. They've earned my trust, I think, is the point to all of this. They have earned the trust to say, hey, they're going to be fine. This isn't like last year. This isn't like Rojas. This isn't like Callaway. So I think that's true. But you definitely want to go all out now in the biggest series of the year and not say, well, we're in the playoffs anyway, so it doesn't matter if we get swept and we go to the wild card. Now, I'm sure if that happens, that's what they'll say. Hey, we're in the playoffs. But I think to a man, they don't want to go in as a wild card. I think everybody in that room wants to go in as a division winner. And I think Buck wants to go in as a division winner too. But we're going to find, and we're going to find out if there's a situation where Edwin Diaz can pitch the eighth and ninth inning in Atlanta to nail down a game. I think it's going to happen. I think Buck is going to make that happen and play for today and worry about tomorrow. And I think that's what Buck does so well. He knows when to play for today, and he knows when to play for 162. Unlike Luis Rojas, who it seemed always played for 162 and never worried about the task that was in front of him at that moment. So that's why, yes, I do think it is imperative that they win the division. But I do like how Buck has managed things, and I don't think that's going to be a concern. I think the Mets will play to get that division and go all out these three games, and then hopefully they win two out of three, and then when we get to that last Wednesday of the season, hopefully it's a Trevor Williams start.
So, Sam, picking up on that.
Yeah, right. That's good.
I'm waiting for that Stan Jefferson lineup. I'm keeping my fingers crossed for that.
Like Rizzo the other day. I wonder which player is going to be the active manager.
Right. So, Sam, back to that. You know, let's bring this one home on the division versus the wild card. I get annoyed when I hear people say, oh, you know, it's only second year of Cohen. And I think it's a kind of a loser's mentality. I think it's almost like you're saying, okay, we expect to lose a division, but we still did all these things. You see, you can't take that away from us. It irks me. Does it bother you that much, or am I crazy?
No, I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen it so much that it bothers me, I guess. I think it's weird because it's both a maybe prepping for if it happens, knowing that it could, and trying not to kind of look at it poorly the way other fans would. I guess the ones who, you know, maybe it is a good kind of defense mechanism. So going into the playoffs, you're not overthinking it like the people who wanted them to win the division forcefully. It doesn't bother me necessarily. I guess that's my analysis on it.
Okay. All right. So now let's talk about the series in Atlanta. You know, I'm kind of a weather geek. People don't know that. I was originally a meteorology major. So I say that to say that I don't think there are going to be weather issues. I really don't. Looking at the track of the hurricane, I think we're going to get more rain here, and we will definitely, not even a question, we will get more rain in the tri-state area than they will get in Atlanta. Atlanta's probably going to get some, like, random showers. We're going to get a good soaking on Saturday. But anyway, that having been said, these games will go off as scheduled, and that's good. You know, you don't want to see this nonsense of delays and all that stuff, and it just messes with your pitching. Let's talk scenarios, gentlemen. Okay, let's start doomsday. Mets get swept. They pretty much lose the division. They would go into the last three games of the season down two with three to play and forget it, right? And the Braves would have a tiebreaker, so just forget it. The Braves would have to be swept by Miami, and the Mets would have to sweep Washington to win the division. So that's scenario one. Mets win one game, which I think is a possibility. They win just one game. It's not the worst possible thing, because if the Mets win just one game, they're technically tied going into the last three games. But as we know, because the Mets win that one game, they would have the tiebreaker over the Braves. So the Mets would have their fate in their own hands. If they went out and swept Washington, nothing the Braves could do about it. The Mets would win the division even if the Braves swept the Marlins. If the Braves would have to outplay the Mets, is what I'm saying, over the last three, if the Mets win one of the three. All right, now, if the Mets win two out of the three, I say it is over, because then the Mets leave their two games up with the tiebreaker, so the only scenario where the Mets don't win the division is if the Braves sweep Miami and the Mets get swept by Washington, and I think Citi Field would collapse if that were to happen. So I don't see that really happening. So those are our scenarios, right? And if the Mets sweep the Braves, they win it outright. So Mets get swept, Mets win one, Mets win two. I'm going to ask you, Sam, I'll start with you on this one.
realistically, what do you see happening here? And let's be mindful that it's DeGrom, Scherzer, and Bassett. So that's about the best the Mets can throw. It is the best the Mets can throw out there. And that's pretty damn good. So what are you feeling here? What do you feel like is going to happen in this series, and why?
It's interesting because you look at the matchups, and I'd like to see some of the other Brave ones, but when you look at just specifically Jacob DeGrom versus Max Fried, that's pretty tight right there. And, you know, DeGrom's coming off a bad start, and usually when he is, he's pretty upset, and in a good way. So something to maybe look forward to there. I think that the Mets are really lucky that Eduardo Escobar gave them a serious emotional boost, and that the Nats, you know, were able to hold off and play spoil. And that could have, you know, considering how listless they looked at certain points, maybe, you know, that moment that it would just right now, especially is so recently iconic. I think maybe gave them the juice again, and hopefully that helps with how much electricity there's going to be going into that first pitch. Mets have the opportunity to give Jacob DeGrom a little bit of cushion, and I hope that they choose to do so if they can be ever so focused.
So give me a prediction. How do the Mets do in the series?
Oh, 2 out of 3. I'm not going to go with, you know, obviously we'll be on cloud 9 if they sweep this thing. But this team has seized the moment throughout the year, and maybe they can do it one more time before the playoffs to really just put a chisel in stone that this franchise is different. And I'm saying my prediction's 2 out of 3, but wouldn't it be nice by the Beach Boys?
There you go. All right, John, same question to you. How do you see this playing out in Atlanta, and why?
Okay, well, the first thing I will say is that the Mets have never won a division like this. The Mets have won a lot of divisions. The Mets have won their divisions either by dominating all season, like 86 and 88, and then or zooming back from the pack and then winning by a mile, like 69, like 15. And I guess the one outlier was 73, but 73 was such a weird year where they were back so far, and then they won with an 82 and 79 record. So maybe you could, but I wouldn't consider this an analogy to 1973. This is a team that's led the division pretty much from start to finish, save for a couple of days here and there. So to Sam's original point, I think it would be a real jolt to the franchise and the fan base to be able to not only win a division in quite this way, but to basically put it away in Atlanta, which has been such a bugaboo for the Mets over the past 20 years, more so in Turner Field than at Truist Park. So I do think that this would be huge, but it's funny. I just got a message from a friend of mine that said, you know what, if the Mets win the first game, that puts all the pressure on Atlanta, all of it. You're talking a young team that's going to be playing some of the biggest games that they've ever played in a pennant race. And I'm not talking about the guys who were there last year. You're talking about you got rookies like Michael Harris, Vaughn Grissom playing. How are they going to react to this kind of game? They might react very well. They've reacted to everything else very well. But if the Mets win that first game, I think that tells the story. And I think that's the game, like I talked about before, that's the game that I think the Mets are really going to try hard to win. If Diaz has a chance to go 8-9, if DeGrom goes 7 and Diaz has a chance to go 8-9, I think Buck's going to push it, because now you put all the pressure on Atlanta if you win that first game, and you got Scherzer the next day. So I'm going to say 2 out of 3, but I'm going to hedge a little bit and say that first game is going to be key, because I think Scherzer wins game 2. I think the Mets will struggle with a pitcher like Morton and the type of stuff he has. So I think they'll drop game three, not through any fault of Chris Bassett, because I think he's going to pitch very well. If DeGrom takes home game one, and if Diaz takes it home for two innings, I think that puts the pressure on Atlanta, and I think we're talking about a 2 out of 3.
Very good. You're right. I completely agree that game one is the key game, and a lot of people are saying that's why he's pitching DeGrom, he being Buck, is choosing to pitch DeGrom. But you can go either way on this one. I mean, you can go Scherzer, you can go DeGrom. Scherzer will be on normal rest. DeGrom, you know, is going to be on he'll be on 6 days. So he's choosing DeGrom because he wants it to hammer down, and you're right. If the Mets win tomorrow night, they're pretty well set. Because even if they were to lose the next two, like I said, they would walk out of Atlanta with their fate in their own hands. Now, I know, you know, beating bad teams, we'll get to that in a minute, isn't necessarily the Mets' forte, but they would have their fate in their own hands. As long as they kept winning, there's nothing the Braves could do. So winning that first game is huge, and the Braves might feel the pressure in the next two. That is true, because they would not want to lose 2 out of 3. They lose 2 out of 3, the division's over. They're a wild card. I mean, seriously. It should be interesting. I completely agree with the what did Jackie Robin say? The fierce urgency of now to win that first game. That'll set the entire tone. All right. So
and
we talked about
if I can also relate it to when the Braves came into Citi Field for that crazy 5-game series. There was a lot of that, you know, win that first game for Buck and you know, this is obviously even more crucial but similar.
Absolutely. And, you know, we'll see how this plays out, but you have to like your chances whenever Jacob DeGrom's on the mound. You have to like your chances right there. Now, granted, he's going up against Max Fried, who is very, very good, and it's in Atlanta. So it's just going to be exciting, you know. And I think we could summarize it like this. We want 3 out of 3. It's great. Probably not going to happen. We want 2 out of 3. We want it badly, because we want to make it so those last three games are essentially meaningless. That's only one thing to happen. They'll either need to win a game or Atlanta to lose a game, and the division is theirs. The magic number would be 1 at that point if the Mets took 2 out of 3 because of the tiebreaker. But they just can't get swept. I mean, that's the scenario that you have to avoid. Even if, like I said, even if you win one, your fate's in your own hands. Not ideal, but very livable. Don't want to get swept in that. They have three fantastic pitchers going out there, and that's why this team is built this way. You know, that's why they focus on the starting pitching. How often do you see teams with pitchers like this get swept in a series? Not very often. Mets haven't been – they're only swept at home once all year, and we'll talk about that in a minute. So, okay. So here we are. You're listening to the Metsian podcast. We've hit the half-hour mark, and Sam and I are thrilled to be speaking with Mr. Metsradamus himself. And at this point, we usually like to give our guests an opportunity for what we like to call the shameless plug. You know, so, John, if you'd like to talk to people about where they could find your work, where you are on Twitter, where your written work is. I know you have a podcast as well. If you'd like to share any of that right now, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. You'd even like to throw in, I don't think you and I have ever talked about this, how you became a Mets fan. So tell us.
Well, you know, I do have a podcast. It's kind of been dormant the past year, but yes, I do. I have had the Burger Bowl podcast. I've had both of you on as guests, which were both fantastic times, fantastic shows. But I make my bones on MetsradamusBlog.com, which is part of the Sports Daily Network, which they've become some sort of they've become primarily a sports betting site. But you know, that's out of my hands. That's above my pay grade. But you can still find my work there. And also on Wednesday evenings, I'm on the Sports Talk. I'm on Sports Talk New York at 7 o'clock every Wednesday with Mark Rosenman and AJ Carter. And we're on the 365 Sports app. If anybody wants to dial that in, I'm the first 5 minutes of the show, so you can dial in and then get out quick. Except, but they have some great interviews, some great guests afterwards. So that's. That's where you can find me, and also at Metsradamus on Twitter. To answer your second question, how I became a Mets fan, it's fairly simple, honestly. I lived within a couple of miles of Shea Stadium, and now I'm within 3-4 miles of Citi Field now. So So I never really left the area, but my dad took me to a game when I was 5 years old, and through the best of my recollection, I was able to ascertain that May 5th, 1976 was my first game. I remember Tom Seaver pitching, and I remember them beating the Reds 5-4, and Skip Lockwood got the save. Those are all things I remembered, so I looked it up, thankyoubaseballreference.com, and I ascertained that that was the game. And then when I was 9 years old, when I was 8 years old, I went to nine games in 1979. And that's the team that hooked me. They hooked me into basically following baseball and rooting for the Mets. I don't know how, because they lost 99 games and they lost all nine games that I went to at Shea Stadium that year. But I clearly remember listening to the last three games of the season on the radio against St. Louis. And they needed to win all three games to avoid 100 losses. Those were the stakes in that series. And somehow they did it, and they avoided 100 losses. And I loved them for it, and I was so happy. You know, the simple things that make a kid's day, winning three games to avoid 100 losses. And I've been hooked ever since.
You know, I bet Kevin Colbert had something to do with that, right, with not losing those last three games. I remember that season pretty well. And, you know, it's amazing. When I started following the Mets, it was in the mid-70s as well. And while they had a couple of good years on the front end of that, you know, it was like, okay, kid, here's your new favorite baseball. Here's your favorite baseball team. Now let's go into the abyss, you know, and going into the Seaver trade and everything, 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, although 83 was the beginning of the Renaissance. So, yeah, so our paths are fairly similar. So I'm thrilled to say, and John, thank you for telling us about yourself during our what we like to call our reset. And I'm also thrilled to say that Mr. Mike LeColant, our third co-conspirator in podcasting, has been able to join us. He's now on the line. So, Mike, how are you doing tonight?
Hello, hello. Doing well. Glad to be on the Metsian podcast with you guys. Hello, Metsville.
Awesome. We're happy to have you,
Mike.
And so now, where we've been, and we have John, of course, and a Metrodamus. So where we've been so far, Mike, is, you know, we talked about the upcoming series in Atlanta. We talked about division versus wild card and level of importance that we place on it and how important it is to us and how we think the team should be approaching it. Let's talk about how we've gotten to this point, okay? So it's been 3 weeks since we've done a podcast, and I want to start with last night. Now, I had the thrill of being at that game last night, and I will tell you that it was deader than a doornail in Citi Field. It seemed dead. I wasn't there Tuesday night, but it seemed dead Tuesday night. And I don't think it's so much the fans are interested. I think the fans were more or less nervous. Like, I think it was more of like a quiet kind of an uncomfortable thing as opposed to just, you know, not interested. And it was kind of creepy there for a while. And then the Marlins pull ahead, and it's like, oh, my God. But I will tell you, when Escobar hit that home run, the place, everything turned. Everything turned. The dugout went crazy, much more than you would think when you're still down two runs. There was a sigh of relief in the crowd. It was almost like we felt they were going to win this game, and we felt that there. I don't know. What I'm trying to say is, and Sam, you alluded to this earlier about it being an iconic moment, there was just a feeling there last night, and I'm sure it permeated into the TV audience as well, that something very important had just happened when Escobar hit that home run. I'm not even talking about the ultimate win of the game. I'm talking about that moment in time right then. And if something special does happen this year, I love the Philly comeback. I love the game in Dodger Stadium, the Sunday afternoon game when they won with Medina on the mound, you know, a guy that you didn't think could be a closer or, you know, not a closer, just closing it out against the best team in baseball. Loved all that stuff. Loved the 2-3 at home against the Dodgers. There will be, gentlemen, no question in my mind, if something special does happen this year, that Escobar home run was the moment. It was in your bones. You felt it. So I'm going to ask all of you guys if it's too much hyperbole or if you felt it too, what you think of it. Mike, you haven't been with us, so let's start with you. What did you think about all that?
That was a spectacular moment. You know, sitting here watching the games alone, you know, the times where you jump up and down and scream out loud are rare. You know, usually you do that with people around you. But that was one of those moments. And when we last spoke on September 8th, I believe it was, Escobar only had about three home runs and five RBIs at that point. And we left off saying that this guy looks like he wants to be a hero in September. And sure enough, look at the month that he's having, especially down the stretch. He's up to 8 home runs this month, 24 RBIs. His OPS is over a buck. I don't think you could ask for more. And more so than his individual performance, the Mets needed this. Alonso's doing what he's doing. Lindor's doing what he's doing. We need the other players to step it up. And this performance is, you know, phenomenal. I know I'm going to go off the reservation here, but Rich, if you can recall some of the conversations that we had about Michael Conforto.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my main gripes was that he wasn't having a month quite like this at any part of the series. He might have had one during one season. He might have had a month like this during another season. And, you know, watching Escobar play this month, this is the kind of performance that I wish Michael Conforto would have put forth. Be that as it may, it was a great pickup. He struggled a great majority of the season, but, you know, he's filling the role of hero now, and that's exactly what we need, exactly when we need it.
Amen. So, John, I'll go to you next on this one. You've probably seen it. It's been all over Twitter. I believe it was sometime in July or August, Escobar said in one of the interviews, in the postgame interview, he had had a bad game. And he said, I want to give the fans a reason to cheer for me. Well, my God, has he given the fans a reason to cheer for him? John, how about that moment last night? Am I crazy? Was that really something that we could point back to as a special moment? We can get to the game-tying hit and the game-winning hit in a minute, but how about that home run?
Yeah, it's certainly because when you it could have been if the Mets had come back the night before, it would have been that Alonso home run. That made it 4-3, but they couldn't get over that fence, as it were. But certainly last night, again, it was one of those things where it's like, okay, we're down, but here we come. Where that home run happens, okay, here comes the comeback, because this team has shown that they could do it over and over and over again. And, you know, this was, I feel like a lot in past years when the Mets got down early, that was it. They were done. The Mets had the biggest glass jaw in baseball, but that's not the case now. So when you sense that, when you get that home run to put them on the board down by 4, you've got to pay attention. You can't turn it away, because this is the type of team that does this over and over and over again. So certainly, and you're right, I did feel it watching the game. I did feel that energy from the stands, because it was quiet. There was a lot of talk on Twitter about, why aren't there more people in the stands for a pennant race down the stretch? And there's a lot of reasons for that factor into it, for sure. But the one thing is that if you give Mets fans reason to cheer, they will blow the roof off no matter how many people are in the stands, whether it be 20,000, 40,000, or in the days of old Shea, 60,000. Give us a reason. Mets fans just beg for a reason, and that was the reason. Eduardo Escobar's home run was that reason to get them going, and it certainly changed everything. And I certainly, when we look back, and you said we were going to talk about the game-tying hit and the game-winning hit, you know, I point to the ninth inning during the Mets game while the Nationals were in the 10th, and watching both games at once. I remember thinking at that moment, this is what this is all about. This is what scoreboard watching and pennant race baseball is all about. I think for me, that's the moment where I kind of stopped and appreciated it and said, man, this is what we live for as baseball fans. You know, not the stupid discourse on Twitter, not the lunatic sports talk radio hotheads that want half the team designated for assignment every game. It was that moment. And certainly the Escobar home run was the first moment. That was the precursor to what we were experiencing later in the game.
So, Sam, I don't know if you were listening or watching. You could tell us whichever way you were consuming the content, as we say. Did it resonate for you as what could be an iconic moment, the home run?
So in terms of exactly when the home run happened, I mean, I was bartending at Rudy's Bar and Grill, shot a blonde beer for $5 with a free hot dog. Everybody, come on in. There's three TVs, basically, and they're all hooked up to the same cable box. And at that point, you can't so there's no diplomacy, really. Aaron Judge is it. And once he hit that home run, which happened a few moments, basically, like right before that moment, ironically, I basically became less inspired to keep the Yankees game on. So once I knew I was always flipping back and forth one way or another, and I knew that there would probably only be one more at bat, and I think we missed that at bat anyway, but luckily for the public in the bar, he didn't hit another home run. But when I flipped it back, it was 4-2. And I think right after that, they showed Shea goodbye. And everybody, all the old players coming to say goodbye to Shea Stadium back in 2008, because it was the anniversary. And I also thought about the fact that that was the final score of that Marlins game when we said goodbye to Shea Stadium. And I was like, so having not witnessed that home run in person and not exactly knowing what happened because I hadn't checked my game day to see how they scored those two runs, I wanted it not to – I knew that that was basically what they needed to overcome, was that 4-2 score against the Marlins. And so the eighth inning, you know, I don't have the sound on. The music's playing. And that was really where, for me, it felt like, all right, this isn't one of those times where they just leave all these runners on. They're actually going to come through. And sure enough, you know, Mark Canha, who has been the hero so many times, a little cold now, is, you know, batting in front of Escobar the entire game. And I do believe he walked maybe in the eighth inning. So maybe at that point he's helping to set it up. But Escobar is just so in the zone right now. And, you know, way later on in the morning when I got off work around 5:30, 6 o'clock, I watched the rest of the game with the SNY guys from the seventh inning onward, from basically the moment before Escobar's home run. And so I was eventually able to hear the sound and hear everything. But at that particular moment, you know, I'm just focused on Escobar and the way he's hitting right now. He's just he isn't trying to pull a home run. He's not trying to do too much. He's just trying to get. He's basically Wee Willie Keeler with the way he's getting these hits and getting. Other than that home run, of course. He's hitting a home run like that because if you saw the placement of the ball in the strike zone, he is so in the zone, you know, you swing at that pitch. It was just such a neat ball. And the rest of them, he is taking the good pitching that's coming and going with it. And it's brilliant. And it's just absolutely brilliant. And that's something that really stuck out to me even when I wasn't watching with the sound. And I'll tell you one thing, too, that got the entire crowd Jones. And I thought in the moment that the way the camera was working, I thought Nito's double was off the black. But it was just because of the way the camera worked. I was really thinking they were going to review it again. But I think it obviously hit, like, maybe somewhere right below the orange line on the blue. But that's something that got everybody Jones. Edwin Diaz got everybody Jones. He was fantastic. And, of course, Drew Smith feeling the bullpen deal, not letting the runner at second go anywhere, maybe not even tiptoe off to get around. So it was beautiful all around. And I was just, again, like the intersection, you know, I didn't have the volume on, so it wasn't until later that I was even checked right before the Mets walked it off that the Nationals had won. So that was my experience of it last night.
All right, so let's continue to go with that. So momentum turner for sure, the home run. Let's talk about the rest of the game, then I'll just ask you guys to comment on the way the rest of the game played out. So the Mets load the bases on three walks in the bottom of the eighth. McNeil comes up, lefty on the mound, and, you know, I didn't feel it when he came up. I really didn't, and he didn't do it. You know, he little weak pop-up that was caught, you know, I think it was by the shortstop, so it was right behind second base bag. Okay, great, or bad. So now you have two outs. But, you know, I've been around this franchise a long time. I have a lot of scars, and I always think the worst. But I had a feeling Escobar was going to get it done. It was all because of the home run. You know, you just felt, you sensed, to use a Gary Cohen term, it felt like a Mets comeback at that point, no matter what was going to happen. And even though there were now two outs, it was sort of scripted. The hot guy, the hottest guy, is coming up now in this situation. It's going to take a hit, and he's going to deliver the hit, and you know what he did. It was good situational hitting. He pushed it through the right side. The right fielder there, Anderson, has an absolutely phenomenal throwing arm. Pete does not have the best speed in the world. Pete was the trail runner at second base. Head first slide in. It wasn't particularly close play. Great. Tie game. Sam, about Nito's ball, he thought it was out for sure. You know, I watched him. He was Cadillacing around the bases. Down to first base. Now, he's slow anyway, but it wasn't mishandled out there. Hit about halfway up the wall. Does he make third if he's not in his home run trot? I mean, he is so slow. I don't know. Does he or doesn't he? I don't know. But the Mets end up, you know, they end up with men on base, two men on base there, and they're unable to score in the bottom of the ninth. And then in the 10th, you're right, Drew Smith. And then isn't baseball poetic? You know, Escobar, I want to give them a reason to cheer for me. He was the guy with the home run. He was the guy with the game-tying hit. And look who's striding to the plate now with one out and a man on second, the free runner on second, next inning. Who else but Escobar? And he had a chance to get it done, and he did. He got it done in a smart way. You know, they were shifting on him. And when I go to you guys, if you want to talk about Mattingly's decision to walk walk McNeil ahead of Escobar, just try to set a double play, make him bat left-handed, but yet face Escobar, right? He didn't want to face McNeil. He chose to set up a double play, makes sense, put him at his weaker side, makes sense, but at the same time, guy swinging the hottest bat in the lineup. So maybe you could talk about that. Just give me your thoughts on the way the rest of the game played out, what you might have been thinking at any point in the 8th and 9th and 10th innings. So, John, let's start with you on this one.
I think that's what you've said is all on point. It does make you wonder why Mattingly tempted fate there in the 10th inning. Walking McNeil, who hadn't had the success that Escobar did, but still walking him and to face Escobar, who was hitting everything. And as it worked out, he hit a nasty cutter to win the game. He was, and that's your proof right there. I mean, Escobar has been so hot lately. And back when he had that, when he said, you know, I'm going to give the fans a reason to cheer, you just knew that this was too good a player to go the whole season without having one monstrous streak. He had a couple of days where he thought, okay, it's going to start. Here it comes. He had some good days. He had a game where he won it in the 10th, I want to say, like June or July, and then he had like three games in a row with a home run. So you figure it's coming then. But now it's September. Here he is. And it's fascinating. You know, do you want to go to the guy that has had more consistent success like McNeil has, or do you want to go with the hot hitter, and which has been Escobar? And I don't know. It in hindsight, certainly it didn't work out. And you know, but I thought it then. Oh, he's going to walk a guy to get to Escobar, who's driven in four runs, and is as hot as a pistol. It was an interesting call. I know Mattingly only has a week left, so maybe he's trying to find his galaxy brain somewhere. He certainly didn't find it last night. But it was definitely an interesting call. Worked out in our favor. And for Escobar, you know, that post-game interview was just, I think it's a reason why so many people love this team and the way it's constructed. And for those that still don't love the team, that want to still complain about Billy Epler's trading deadline on Twitter, well, there was no hope for you anyway. But Escobar talking about how he wanted to make the fans happy. Not every ball player thinks like that. Certainly these days, not every ball player thinks like that. And it's and listen, it's the way of the world. But to hear guys like Escobar say that I'm going to do this to make these fans happy, and to have such authentic emotion behind it too. I feel the same way when you hear Francisco Lindor talk. It's authentic emotion. It's not just, I'm going to say this because it's what you want to hear. That's what, you know, that's what this whole season has been about for me. And Escobar really captured it in a nutshell after the game.
Absolutely did. And he's a very likable player. A guy who struggled mightily, but now that he's performing like Lindor, you know, obviously he's not the same caliber of player, but you know, Lindor, the fans were on him at first when he first got here, and he's a likable guy. He's genuine. The fans really have taken to him and like they're taking to Escobar. So, Mike, your thoughts, okay, we've talked about the home run. Your thoughts on what you saw the rest of the game. There was so much there. It was such a classic baseball game with chess pieces moving around, you know, all that kind of stuff. Your thoughts as the game progressed.
You're so right. You know, Escobar started the game with two rather weak at-bats. So, you know, you get into later portions of the games, he hits the home runs, he ties the games, and then comes the 10th inning. If I'm Mattingly, if we're talking strategy here, if I'm Don Mattingly, not only do I walk McNeil, I also walk Escobar, because Vientos is next. Why would you want to pitch to Escobar? He's batting .330 for the month of September. Like I said, his OPS is over a buck. Why would you want to pitch to him in that situation? Whereas if you walk him and put two runners on base, now you can get an out at third, second, or first. I think you increase your chances of, you know, inducing a ground ball and getting that double play, but at least you can, flexibility as to where in the infield that ball might be hit. You know, if you got a good relief pitcher, keeps it low, keeps it inside, and induces that ground ball. But I thought that was bad strategy on Mattingly's part. And again, because Mark Vientos was next, would Buck Showalter have pinch hit for him? Possibly. But who are you sending up there? Would you rather pitch to the, pitch to the pinch hitter or Vientos or Escobar? So that was a bad move by Mattingly.
I think you're right. I mean, the Mets had the big, I call him the big man, Vogelback on the bench. He had Naquin on the bench. I'm sure you would have seen one of those guys against the righty. But you're right. You know, that's another piece of the strategy. That's why baseball is the greatest game in the world, because of all these little subtleties. Like, and I'll tell you another one. Sam, we're going to you next, of course, but I'll tell you another one that we were debating. There are a few of us who went last night. And I know the obvious answer here, but just think about it. So after Nito hits the double, they send in Terrence Gore to run for him. Then Nimmo walks. They have first and second one out, bottom of the eighth, right? Bottom of the ninth. First and second, one out. We were talking about it and said, okay, Gore is there. Pete's up, right, with one out. Gore is there to steal the base. He's there to run. What if you try to double steal? Hear me out. We're debating this in the stand. So if the worst scenario that happens is one of the runners is thrown out, and it's likely going to be Nimmo. They're not going to throw Escobar out. All right. So you have that. Now, you still have two outs and a man in scoring position. The prize, though, if it works, is you have second and third run out. They'd probably walk Pete to get pick your poison, Pete or Lindor, but you'd have the winning run on third with one out, fallback position. You have two outs, but still a runner in scoring position. We were debating if this is a good move or not, and I know the obvious, seemingly obvious answer is the one Buck chose, which is, you know, don't tempt it, don't do it, give yourself two cracks. But the thing about it was that's what you could do in baseball. You could talk about this strategy. You know, Sam, I'm going to go to you on the rest of the game. I don't know if you thought about that or not, but what did you think of the way the rest of that game played out?
Well, it was interesting. You know, he wasn't moving at all. He basically just stayed there, and obviously there was some, Buck and even if, you know, I guess obviously Terrence Gore doesn't have, you know, the green light all the time. Otherwise, he might have gone, you know. I mean, he's one of the most people I've ever seen. So I did think about that in the moment. It's just exactly what you're talking about in terms of talking the strategy out in between pitches, as well as what John was talking about where he was watching both games at once. You can identify that back to some of the earlier history, and of course it used to be that what we're experiencing is just for the division, you know, contrasting with like 1941 where it has to do with going to the World Series. But this is, you know, this is just how it is now. And this is like John said, it's not about this new age of fandom on Twitter and wanting to designate everybody for assignment every game. It's about this scoreboard watching. It's about, you know, asking for your team to put you into a position where the second to last series is the most crucial series that has come along during the regular season in ages for this team. So, it's brilliant. Last night was just one of those moments where you're like, there's so many different places. There's so many different intersections every game. There's so many different intersections in another game that is crucial for what your outcome is going to be. So I love this team. I love this sport. And let's go Mets.
So thank you for that, Sam. So, okay, let's back up a little bit more. So now we talked about the upcoming series with the Braves. We talked about the game last night that was, you know, just an iconic classic baseball game, one that you'll see in the 22 highlight reel when they do one over the offseason. I want to probe on this one a little bit. These Mets, in my opinion, and I don't know why, appear a bit schizophrenic. It's the same lineup basically every day. Good starting pitching every day. But yet, they could look bad. I don't know what the word is. So since we last done a podcast, the Mets were swept at home by the Cubs. Let that sink in. Mets were swept at home by the Cubs. Then, yes, they responded, though. And what do? They take a team that's even maybe only slightly worse than the Cubs, and they sweep them 4. Okay. Then they go into Milwaukee, and they clinch a playoff spot by winning 2 out of 3 against a team that is probably going to make the playoffs now instead of the Phillies, because the Phillies are in an epic collapse. So, and they take 2 out of 3 there, clinch their playoff spot. Great. They go into Miami. They, you know, they only, quote, only win 2 out of 3 against a team that they probably should have swept, but you really can't expect to sweep. So there's that. And, you know, going a little further, Oakland, right? They win the first game, have a 3-0 lead first inning in the second game with DeGrom on the mound, and they lose. They come home to Miami, a game that, you know, a lot of baseball fans probably couldn't even name these Marlins who are out there other than Rojas, and they lose. So here's where I'm going with it. Why do you think this team can look so bad at times and then look so good when it's the same group? All right, so there's that piece of it. And now the bigger piece, though, is does this concern you at all going into the postseason? Are you concerned that they could maybe lay an egg and look like the Mets versus Cub Mets? Or do you think that's like, okay, that was a regular season thing. They're going to crank it up a notch. You won't see that kind of thing in the postseason. Interested to see where you guys come down on that. And, Mike, let's start with you.
To answer all angles of that question, I have 2 words, Rich. Starling Marte. He's the difference between making the Mets lineup a good lineup and a formidable lineup. You know, I think the Mets are 15-10 this month, September. That's not bad. It's just that, you know, they came in streaks earlier in the month. We lost three in a row. Then we won six in a row. And then win, loss, win, loss, win, loss. And it seemed like the Braves, every time we won, they won. Every time they lost, we lost. You know, so there's been that tug of war. And it just puts everything under a microscope. But that's my answer, Rich. Starling Marte. He's the difference maker here. He takes a good lineup and he transforms it into a formidable lineup. And that's what we've been missing. So I'm hoping for his healthy and quick return.
That's an excellent take, Mike, because when you think about it, generally speaking, I know McNeil played a little bit of right field, but generally speaking, when Marte is not out there, it's Naquin. It can be Darren Ruff. The drop-off is precipitous between the talent of Marte and the talent of those guys. You're right. Now, maybe with a guy like Marte lengthening that lineup, you don't have these ups and downs. That's a really good take. So, John, we'll go to you next on this one, then Sam will have you clean it up. So, John, what's your take on the schizophrenic Mets, and do you have a potential reason in mind, and are you concerned that it could rear its ugly head in the postseason?
I think I would be concerned even if the Mets weren't so schizophrenic, because it took the Mets this long until September, until Marte's injury, like Mike said, and I'm glad he brought that up. I think it took until then for the Mets to really have those puzzling losses or series losses where they've looked flat and uninspired. Now, I'm of the mind that good pitching will make a team look flat and uninspired. And the Mets have had trouble with lefties all year. And even by trouble, they're still having trouble. They're still pretty good. But guys like Lizardo from last night, or even if we want to go to not a lefty, Assad from the Cubs, who had a nasty breaking stuff the night that he pitched. And he looked good today against the Phillies also. So I do think it's a combination of factors that go into that. The Marte injury means you see a lot more guys like Daniel Vogelbach and Darren Ruff. And I don't think – and Naquin. And I don't think with Marte you see enough of those guys. Or you see not enough you see less of those guys. They're not overexposed. So, and that's why a lot of fans have been really vocal about, oh, Darren Ruff stinks. And, yeah, it does seem like he's forgotten how to play baseball. But why they're talking about it, you know, we got to replace him with Dom Smith. There are some people that are saying that. And I don't – if Ruff gets less at-bats, then it's not really a concern. I don't think it's a concern now. But, yeah, Marte coming back means that those guys aren't exposed like they have been. Now with the case of Darren Ruff, yeah, he had an 850 OPS against lefties this season, and they traded Davis for him, who was struggling. So, you know, I don't want to get in that wormhole about people screaming about that trade. But yeah, they've seen a lot of Darren Ruff, and they've seen a lot of Vogelbach and a lot of Naquin. So I think that might be a part of it. But the Mets still should have enough, you would think, to not get swept by the Cubs, not lose two out of three to the Nationals, who, to their credit, have played the Braves tough lately down the stretch. I think every team has those schizophrenic moments, but the good teams like the Mets this year don't let those schizophrenic moments turn into 10-game losing streaks. And that's what happened last year. They had some schizophrenic moments, and they couldn't come back from that. It's like the whole glass jaw thing. You go back to Lindor saying, yeah, it wasn't really a professional group last year, but it's a professional group this year. So from that, I'm concerned less about the postseason because it is a professional group. And honestly, I don't worry, not that it's guaranteed for the Mets to win the World Series, but I'm not going to ever worry about a postseason team with Max Scherzer on it, because I think he's the glue that has bound that pitching staff together. You see it after every start. They have a discussion in the dugout. I don't remember ever seeing that. And you talk about and the glue that binds the team together. I think Max Scherzer, people have forgotten about him, with everything else going on, and because he's been injured for a while, but he's been that glue to bring this team together, and that's why I don't worry about them going into the playoffs. If they lose, it won't be because they're flat and uninspired, not with Max on the team. No way.
I like that take a lot. Sam, the schizophrenic Mets, do they concern you that they could pull an episode of schizophrenia in the playoffs? And if whether or not on that one, and also why do you think it might be that they could look so good and they could look so bad, and could it just be playing down to the competition? What do you think?
Can I just start this off by saying that Darren Ruff is the second half Joey Gallo in the New York baseball market, but I think it's fair comparison considering how, like John said, he's forgotten how to play baseball. I think that it doesn't concern me in that it's a long season, and you know, once like last night there was a bit of relief in that seventh inning, like we were talking about, from both the dugout as well as in the stand, and I think that some of the energy is back. I think that that's kind of what similarly is going to be the switch one way or another when we get into the playoffs. And I think that John made a really good point about the Scherzer factor. So no, it does not concern me, to put it shorter.
All right. So gentlemen, Sam, I'm going to stay with you. I'm going to give you this one first and we'll go around. Playoff roster. A couple things we have to talk about here that are, I mean, obviously there aren't a lot of question marks when teams make the postseason. Typically their roster is fairly set. But I have two questions that I want to ask the group. Sam first. So, number four starter. You need that in possibly round, the division round, definitely need it in the championship series and World Series. Big debate. Should it be Carlos Carrasco? Should it be Taiwan Walker? You could look at it as, Carrasco, I believe, has 15 wins, which is pretty darn good. And he's the veteran. He's been there, you know, been in the postseason. So should it be Carrasco? Walker, who absolutely hit a wall last year, and I was concerned he would this year, they've both been fairly consistent. They've both had their moments. Obviously, Carrasco was really bad on Tuesday. So, Sam, I'm going to ask you, when you need a fourth starter in the postseason, where are you going and why? And for the right-handed bat to be DHing against left-handed pitching, how are you solving that one? You're gonna go with Ruff and say, look, this is the veteran, this is the guy. You're gonna go with Bientos. How are you solving that one? Those are my two questions for the group.
In terms of starting with the pitching, excuse me. I think that. I gotta lean maybe piggybacking the two of them, Carrasco and Walker. Because one of them is gonna be in the, you know, it's gonna be all hands on deck one way or another when it comes to the bullpen and this idea of how you're gonna use your rotation. Obviously, McGill, and I mean, you know, he threw Drew Smith right back into the fire just to remind him, hey, you're supposed to be a major part. And obviously, in the moment, it didn't work out against the Brew Crew. But still, he kind of, even though everybody was giving him crap that day for doing so, I think that looking back on it, Buff just wants everybody to be, first of all, he's, you know, checking. It's just like, hey, this is a moment, and if you can't handle it, then I know now, so I don't put you there later. But Drew Smith is responding to that, and has so. So I know that that's not exactly what we're talking about. I'm getting a little off topic. It does have to do with one of them will end up in the bullpen and affecting the way the bullpen is used. So in terms of whether Vientos makes it, I haven't seen enough of Vientos yet to say that I prefer him over the veteran, even if the veteran, you know, just doesn't seem to know what he's doing right now. I think that I would probably trust Ruff, but I think Dominic Smith is an interesting factor. I mean, I don't know exactly what the numbers are. Maybe some of you know, but like, what has he been doing at AAA? And I know that he every here and there I would see some alert that said he got an RBI or a hit here and there on the Syracuse feed. So I think Dom Smith is an interesting topic in all of this, and we're probably getting some roster moves tomorrow now that the Syracuse season is over. Hey, Rich, you there?
Oops, sorry about that. Dollar in the jar. Dom is a guy that, you know, he's been around. You'd love to see him be rewarded with a trip to the postseason, absolutely. Problem is he's not a right-handed hitter. And you know, he doesn't really solve the problem. Unless you want to put him on the roster over Vogelbach or over Naquin, that's a different issue. I don't think they would do that. But he doesn't solve the right-handed hitting problem. And so that's a tough one. So, Mike, I'll go to you. Give me your fourth starter, and how would you address right-handed DH/bench piece?
That's a tough one. We're obviously talking about Tuan Walker and Carlos Carrasco. Who would you choose? They have, you know, roughly the same amount of innings. I'm a fan of whip, and, you know, Tuan Walker, less hits than innings pitched, whereas Carlos Carrasco is above that number. And he creates these predicaments for himself that he's got to get out of. And he has more strikeouts than Walker, but he's pitching out of more jams. He's crafty. I'll give him that. I have confidence in him. But going into the playoffs, Rich, I'm going to go with Tuan Walker. There's a part of me that also thinks his velocity would serve the Mets better coming out of the bullpen in the playoffs, but I don't want to go that route. I want to go with a fourth good starter in the playoffs, because that's going to be the defining factor, as John mentioned, in the playoffs. And that brings up the right-handed batter. I don't know. I'm going to have to make this decision after the Marlins series and before the playoffs. Excuse me. I have to know whether we're a division winner or if we're a wild card team. Obviously, if we go in as a wild card team, there's no break per se. We keep playing. If we win the division, there's that little break. Bringing up Dom, you're asking him to readjust to major league pitching, and not just major league pitching, not pedestrian pitchers of baseball. Now we're talking and asking him to adapt to playoff caliber pitching. I think we're best. We probably stick with what we have right now and hope for the best. But as insofar as who, that's going to be a last-minute decision, because nobody's, you know, doing anything that stands out and makes us want to point a finger and say, that's the guy. So we just got to wait and see.
I think that's fair. I don't think anybody's won the job. You're right. They've done a lot to lose it. Nobody's actually done anything to win it. So, John, as I go to you for your fourth starter and right-handed DH/bench piece. You know, I was watching the game by myself on Tuesday night, and I was literally going crazy here because nobody was talking about the fact that Carrasco's – Mike, reminded me about this. Carrasco's velocity was around 91. He was throwing a four-seam fastball at 91. That's not normal. Now, is he has he hit an innings limit? Remember, this guy didn't pitch until late July last year. Are we seeing an innings, like a maxing out here of Carrasco? But his velocity was way down Tuesday night. Does that in any way influence your decision about the fourth starter? So, John, take it on the fourth starter on the right-handed DH.
It's a valid point you bring up about Carrasco's velocity, but it doesn't affect my decision because my decision was Walker anyway. Going into the playoffs, I think, you know, Walker's struggled here and there. But Walker, I think, has been a little better down the stretch than Carrasco in the way that when Carrasco's gotten hit, he's gotten hit in bunches. He'll give up, like, the last game, 4 runs in 3 innings. Or against a team like Houston, 4 runs in the first inning I think two straight games, four runs in the first inning against a good team like Houston, and he's going to be facing good teams. I think the deciding factor for me is that give me the guy who's got better stuff over the guy who has less stuff but has to have pinpoint accuracy to be successful. That's a dicey proposition in the playoffs. Give me the guy whose off-speed stuff is working very well. Give me Taiwan Walker's splitter. Give me his off-speed stuff over Carrasco's off-speed stuff. So at least to start, give me Taiwan as the fourth starter. As the right-handed DH, I can't go with Vientos. He just looks, for the most part, overmatched in the major leagues. And then just to hand that to him for people to say, well, you know, hey, he's a good prospect. Let's see what he can do. The playoffs are not the time for that. I think they're going to have to ride it out with Darren Ruff unless you want to use his roster spot to put Terrence Gore on the postseason roster and utilize his plus skills, because he at least can give him defensive stolen bases, whereas Ruff really can't right now. So maybe you go that route, but you do need a right-handed presence on that bench. So listen, you got Eduardo Escobar found it. I think the Mets are in a position where they have to hope that Darren Ruff has found it, because they don't really have a lot of other options. Like you said, Dom Smith doesn't hit, is not a right-handed batter. He doesn't hit left-handers, and he really hasn't hit anybody in the last 2 years. And people that want Dom in have forgotten that he hasn't had a home run in like a year and a half. So I would be careful pushing that button. I think you go with what you got now, and you pray. Honestly, and then you hope that Marte comes back so that the at-bats that you would need filled by Darren Ruff are minimal.
And I think we've landed on the presence of Marte and how important it is. And I think the thing is, he's still in a splint. So maybe the Mets, I know we talked about this, this is how we started the show, about the wild card versus division. Maybe the division, if we're saying Marte is as important as we're saying he is, and the Mets could buy an extra week. They could finish their season on Wednesday and not have to play again until the following Tuesday. That's six more days for Marte to heal. Maybe we have to start thinking about that, too, as yet another reason why the division is so much more important. Because, you're right, Marte matters. I mean, he makes them better against left-handed pitching. He lengthens the lineup against any-handed pitching. And his absence is an issue. It absolutely is. So, gentlemen, we have reached the end of our time together. I'll say this as, you know, a final comment here. Anything on your minds, we can kind of do like an open forum here. Anything on your minds to talk about? I think we've hit on the key things here. But is there anything that is on your minds pressing that you'd like to discuss before we part ways? All right. I will take that as a no. So with that said, it's time for our shameless plug / last word. So before we do that, I'd like to once again thank Mr. Metrodamus himself, John, for coming on our podcast again and sharing your wisdom and your insights. Always a pleasure to have you on. So let's start with you. At this point, we typically tell people to remind the audience what you do outside of this podcast and where people could find it, and what your last word for the evening may be.
Well, My Twitter handle is at Metrodamus. Come find me there, or at MetrodamusBlog.com, or on the Sports Talk New York on Wednesdays, 365 Sports Talk app, Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. And so you could find me at all of those places and more. And I'm so grateful to be on here to talk baseball and to talk Mets with you. The one thing I will bring up, because I'm not going to complain about why people don't understand that four players for Darren Ruff doesn't necessarily mean that the Mets got fleeced in the deal. I still don't believe that, but I'll leave that aside. The one thing I will say is that the Mets got swept by the Cubs in September. But think about this. The Phillies situation is more tenuous than ours, and they got swept by the Cubs, not only this series, but for the entire season series 0-6, 0-7, the Phillies went. And I think it shows you what happens when you've got it, what can happen when you have a team that is playing for something going against a team that has nothing to lose. I think the Mets did run into a little of that going down the stretch, to go back to the schizophrenic nature of it. But again, they have found their way to not completely fall off the cliff and get their bootstraps up and not have that killer losing streak to murder them. Yes, they could have made their lives so much easier by just beating the Cubs 2 out of 3 and beating the Nats 2 out of 3 back in early September. Didn't happen, but they responded as well as a Mets team, I think, has ever responded to adversity like that. And I give them a lot of credit, because it's easy to get enveloped by the noise from the fan base and from social media and to let it live in your head. This team hasn't let that happen to them, to their credit. And I think that's why, more than anything, I give this team a very, very reasonable shot to win 2 out of 3 in Atlanta, because this team is mentally tougher than a lot of Met teams that we've seen recently. So that's what I'm going to go with. First game is going to be the key, but honestly, this is so much fun. This season has been so much fun. I can't wait for Friday. I really cannot wait for game one tomorrow night.
Absolutely. Mike, your shameless plug / last word for the evening.
Shameless plug, Brooklyn Trolley blogger. Yesterday, in the year 1890, the Brooklyn Bridegrooms clinched their first ever National League pennant. I've been redoing the whole season, and they got a couple of games left before they enter an agreed-upon, quote-unquote, World Series against the Louisville Colonels of the American Association. So that's ahead. Last word, as John said, and thank you for joining us this evening. This is a lot of fun. Showdown. You can't ask for more. The defending world champions are playing in their own house. And here come the Mets, a game ahead. It boils down to this. Sam knows how I make the distinctions between 19th century baseball, 20th century baseball, which I grew up on and became passionate about, and this nonsense we call 21st century baseball. At least this still remains. Baseball at its core is all about this. 3 games and Atlanta. Mets, Braves, National League, baseball. I love it. I just hope we do well. I'm not gonna do a cockroach stomp on what has been one of the best seasons in Mets history. We're at 98 games, 6 left to play. Let's hit the century mark. And let's make this one of the greatest seasons ever. Because if you remember, not too long ago, the expectations for this team were, let's play meaningful games in September. We don't have to address who that came from. But we've exceeded that. Expectations are different. So Friday night fever, Saturday night fever, and hopefully Sunday fun day are still ahead. Let's go, Mets.
Awesome. Got me even more pumped up. Sam, as our chief operating officer, podcasting operations, your shameless plug and last word for tonight.
Oh, well, shameless plug, converted Mets fan, lots of articles from yonder lore, but unfortunately I got to reboot it up. But right now I'm kind of following the superstitious world, and I haven't been writing this entire season, so I will continue to not. You can find me here on this podcast when it comes to Mets-related stuff, just hearing my voice and whatever I write on Twitter currently, But, you know, yeah, we'll look back into converted Mets fan way down the road. I almost used the word yonder again. Apparently that's my word of the night. But not my final word. My final word, other than Bedford and Sullivan, the story of Brooklyn and its Dodgers that I'm always working on from a filmmaking perspective, trying to create a narrative dramatic series regarding it, many different platforms that you can do that with now. Who knows whether I can eventually get one to agree that this needs to be told. But one way or another, my final word is persevere. Looking throughout the entire Mets season, that's all they've been doing. Here they are going in a game up on the Braves to defend their lead in the division against the defending world champions. It's not so often that the Mets are ever in this position to write their own destiny. And here we go. I echo what everybody said about the echoes of this game to the past, even as it sometimes looks like a different Frankenstein version of the game that everybody grew up on. You still have this, like everybody said. And the Mets, they're not down a game. They're not tied. Yesterday brought them to a game above. And you can't, you could maybe ask for something better, maybe going in a little higher, but this, it's not what the destiny is. The destiny is you're a game up with three to play against your closest division rival. Let's do this. Persevere. Let's go Mets. Thanks, Rich.
I love everything I heard. Mike, your words pump me up for, as John did. This is what it's all about, man. You know, this is when the baseball lockout thing was happening over the winter. This is what we wanted. We wanted pennant race, exciting baseball. We have it. So I'm even more excited. Sam, you hit the nail on the head. You part of what John said too, doesn't have a glass jaw. This team does persevere. This team isn't going to go into Atlanta and meekly, you know, go away and meekly, you know, get swept away. This team has a lot of fight in it. It perseveres. It's been through a lot, especially in September, you know, the schizophrenic play, but they persevere. They're going to show up. It's going to be fun. We don't know how it's going to play out. That's, you know, as we say, that's why they play the games, but this is going to be a fun weekend. Look forward to connecting with you guys again as we go into the postseason, which, as we talked about earlier, you know, is assured at this point. So we'll definitely have something to say before the postseason starts. Hopefully it's as a division winner. Gentlemen, thank you as always. Thank you to the listeners. We don't, you know, we would not be able to do this without you. We appreciate whether you're listening live, whether you're listening on a podcast, wherever you find your podcast. Very much appreciate it. Appreciate the interactions we get on Twitter. Sam and Mike, guys, always a pleasure working with you guys, chatting baseball with you. Mr. John, Mr. Metrodamus, you know, I so enjoy talking baseball with you. Thank you for joining us tonight. Have a great night, everybody. Everybody, you know, enjoy this weekend. This is what it's all about. And let's go Mets this weekend. Let's try to take home a division and have a great night. Good night, everybody.
See you on the other side, guys. Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets.
Let's go Mets. Later, guys.
Thanks.